Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell. In the great American Southwest, the deserts. No pyramids that I know of, but the deserts. I wish you all a great good morning and good evening, depending on your time zone across all these many, from the Tahitian and Hawaiian Islands, east to the Caribbean and the U.S. Virgin Islands, south into South America, north to the pole, worldwide on the internet. And that's getting to be a mouthful. Good morning, this is Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell. As promised, with us this morning is Graham Hancock, author of Fingerprints of the Gods, The Sign and the Seal, and the recent The Message of the Sphinx. I will learn with you this morning, and what a journey it's going to be. Right, here we go. Now, as promised on his American tour in Chicago in a hotel room where he's probably not going to get very much sleep, here's Graham Hancock. Graham, hi.
Hi, good morning to you.
Oh, it's so good to hear your voice without the delay that we get when I called you one night in London.
Yes, that's right, or one morning as it was in my case, yes.
That's right.
Absolutely, we had a bad line that time.
Well, listen, it's great to have you on the program, and Richard Hoagland, who I have interviewed many, many times, badgered me as if he had to get you on the program. And then
Richard and I, together with my co-author Robert Vaval, presented two major conferences recently in England, one at Imperial College London and the other at Leeds University, where we made common cause with Richard on the issue of freedom of information and freedom of knowledge and freedom of ideas, because the work that Richard is doing, particularly regarding the structures, the apparent structures on Mars, is of enormous importance and enormous interest, and we feel that it's extraordinary that this work has not been followed up by the powers that be, and we've been trying to draw attention to that with him in England, and it has many points in common with the suppression of knowledge regarding the pyramids and the Great Sphinx of Egypt.
Yes, you and I have common cause. I have done the same thing with Richard, and I guess, Graham, the answer is that a lot of scientific paradigms and careers are challenged by tampering with conventional wisdom.
Yes.
In those areas. Graham, before we get started, tell us a little bit about Graham Hancock. Not everybody knows. What is your background, Graham?
My background, well, how far shall we go back? I was born in 1950 in Edinburgh in Scotland, so I'm 45 years old now.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in India as a child. My father is a medical doctor, and we lived in southern India. I went to university in the north of England, and I became a journalist and a writer. I worked for The Economist newspaper and wrote regularly for the London Sunday Times and The Guardian and other newspapers. I was deeply interested in Africa and in the events of Africa. I covered the war between Somalia and Ethiopia in 1977 as a war correspondent. I lived in East Africa for several years in Somalia and in Kenya. I was finally the East Africa correspondent for The Economist, visited Ethiopia many times. And it was through visiting Ethiopia, and at that time with purely an interest in politics and famine and wars and economics, that I came across Ethiopia's extraordinary claim to possess the Lost Ark of the Covenant, as in Raiders of the Lost Ark,
yes.
The biblical ark that supposedly contained the Ten Commandments written by the finger of God. And I discovered that this claim was ridiculed by scholars. They regarded it as laughable and as funny and as a primitive superstition. But the more I looked into it, the more intriguing it seemed to me that it was. Ethiopia is the only country in the world that claims to possess this amazing relic. And there's a living tradition of worship of the Ark of the Covenant in Ethiopia. And there's an indigenous population of Ethiopian Jews who practice the pre-Talmudic Judaism. They seem to have been cut off from the main body of Judaism for thousands of years. And I thought, hey, this claim to possess the Ark of the Covenant is not without foundation, and I decided to look into it initially from the perspective of an investigative reporter, an investigative journalist, and it led me down an avenue of discovery and learning concerning the mysteries of the past of humanity, because I came to realize that we're a species with amnesia, that we all know almost nothing about our own past, and therefore we know almost nothing about ourselves. And researching and writing The Sign and the Seal, the book about the Ark of the Covenant, led me to Egypt and the mystery of the sudden, fully formed emergence of Egyptian civilization at around 3,000 years ago, apparently out of nowhere. And that led me into the mystery of a lost civilization, which is what I cover in Fingerprints of the Gods, and finally returning to this matter in much greater depth in The Message of the Sphinx. So that's Graham Hancock as a writer and as an investigator. I'm a family man. I have six children. I've been married twice before, and I'm married again now. My wife is Santa. She's a wonderful woman. She's changed my life. She's brought meaning and spirituality into my life, and we pursue this quest for knowledge and learning together.
Is it a driven thing with you, Graham? Are you driven to do this?
I feel totally caught up and captivated and entranced by the mystery of the past. I feel that there has been a huge forgotten episode in human history, a lost civilization, a chapter in the story of mankind that we have forgotten entirely, and that this lost, forgotten period in our history is unrepresented in the modern world. It has no ambassadors in the modern world. Nobody speaks for the past. Our scholars simply write off the prehistory of mankind as a period of primitive superstition when men lived in caves, and they don't realize the mystery and the magic that lies there. And what I sense is an ancient voice trying to come through to us through the veil of the past, and I have tried to speak for that ancient voice, to give it a voice in the modern world, to allow it to be heard, and to do so with reason and with argument. There's a great deal of wishy-washy material out there in the so-called New Age field where people speculate wildly and have woolly ideas, and this is not going to change the way that people think. The only way that we can change a paradigm, that we can change the fixed and rigid system of ideas, is to fight that system of ideas on its own terms. And that's what I've tried to do in my books, particularly in Fingerprints of the Gods and in the new book, The Message of the Sphinx, is to present solid, reasoned evidence which any person with common sense can see makes sense and which does challenge the existing view of history.
Well, there might be some who would say that you, in fact, are all wrong. In fact, a lot of people, Graham, who have a lot at stake, you know, in the traditional paradigm, entire lives and careers and theorems are built about the way it was supposed to be.
Yes.
So how is all this received by peer colleagues?
Well, you know what? The conclusion that we're coming to, particularly with the Egyptian material that I cover in Fingerprints of the Gods and that we go into in more depth in the Message of the Sphinx, is that, in a sense, the Egyptologists, who are the self-appointed specialists in this area, have made themselves irrelevant to the argument. We no longer seek their approval. We no longer seek their acceptance of our ideas in this field. The evidence that we present speaks for itself, and our strategy and our policy is to go directly to the public. When I say when I speak in the plural, I'm talking here about Robert Bovall and myself. He's the author of a book called The Orion Mystery, which presented the Orion correlation, an extraordinary breakthrough in the understanding of the pyramids, and he and I got together to work on the Message of the Sphinx. And what we feel is that the Egyptologists are irrelevant to this argument. The public are not listening to them anymore. The tired old theories about the pyramids being tombs of megalomaniac pharaohs, the fixed and rigid idea of what ancient Egypt was, is just no longer accepted by the majority of the general public today. And the burden of proof has shifted. It's no longer on us to prove that we are right. It's now for the Egyptologists to prove that we are wrong. But it's not acceptable anymore for them to stand up there and say, well, listen, I'm the professor of Egyptology at the Oriental Institute in Chicago, and I know that you guys are wrong, and therefore please go away. The public just won't accept that anymore. As a matter of fact, when I say the word Egyptologist at public conferences and conventions these days, the word alone causes the whole audience to burst into laughter.
Listen, Graham, don't be afraid to get in their face.
I'm not.
That was a joke. All right, Graham, exactly what are the pyramids?
Okay. Let's first of all deal with the Egyptological orthodoxy. They tell us that the three great pyramids of Egypt are the tombs of three megalomaniac pharaohs, Khufu, Khafre, and Menkaure, three pharaohs of the fourth dynasty who ruled at around the period of 2,500 BC. And they say that that's all they are, tombs and tombs only. They say that the Great Sphinx is a monumental statue that was carved to aggrandize the ego of one of those pharaohs, Pharaoh Khafre, and that the face of the Sphinx is carved in his image and that it was created in 2,500 BC. And if you look this matter up in any encyclopedia, or if you read it in any orthodox popular text, such as the National Geographic magazine or the misleadingly named Time, Life, Lost Civilization series, you'll see this same tired, old theory being regurgitated again and again as though it were the revealed truth of God. And nobody ever tells us that that's all it is. It's just a theory. It's just the opinion of a very few, by the way, scholars. It's just their opinion based on no facts whatsoever. The Egyptological notion that the Great Pyramids are tombs is purely and simply a matter of opinion. No burial of any pharaoh has ever been found inside those colossal and extraordinary monuments. They are completely bare. They contain no inscriptions whatsoever. They are stark, austere, and anonymous. They stand out there on the Giza Plateau, begging the intelligent and the curious to work out what they are. But they tell us one thing very definitely about themselves, that they were built by master astronomers and master engineers with skills and talents almost beyond human imagining. The
Graham, you said that there was nothing in them, at least no burial point.
No burials,
fine.
No mummified body ever found,
all right,
no sarcophagus ever found.
Gotcha. What is in them? Aren't there chambers and so forth and so on? Now, I've never been there, so I don't know.
All of the three pyramids of Giza have chambers in them.
Yes.
Known chambers, and as we show in the message of the Sphinx, as yet undiscovered chambers as well. The two secondary pyramids, the second pyramid and the third pyramid, have just one major chamber each. The third pyramid has a group of smaller chambers as well, and these are underground. They're both, the chamber systems are under the ground, under the base of the pyramid, but the Great Pyramid, the pyramid that Egyptologists attribute to Khufu, contains a subterranean chamber, which is 100 feet below ground.
Mm-hmm.
It contains the so-called Queen's Chamber, and this attribution is purely arbitrary. There's no basis for it, which is in the superstructure of the monument, about 100 feet above ground. And about a further 100 feet above that, there's a third, much larger chamber with a group of smaller chambers above it. These are massive cavities, in some cases, inside the body of this 6-million-ton monument. They're joined up by an intricate network of corridors and passageways. And mysteriously, in the Great Pyramid, there are four very narrow shafts, two of them from the so-called King's Chamber. These are 8 inches wide and 8 inches high, cut all the way through the body of the monument. They rise at an incline, at an angle, and they exit on the outside of the monument. But the two lower shafts from the so-called Queen's Chamber do not exit on the outside of the monument. They stop somewhere inside that vast 6-million-ton bulk. And this, the mystery of these shafts is one of the issues that we investigate in the Message of the Sphinx, because at the end of one of those shafts, in 1993, after an exploration by a small robotic camera, was discovered a door complete with two metal handles. And an amazing archaeological scandal surrounds what has happened concerning that door and the chamber that lies beyond it, and also a chamber that lies deep beneath the Great Sphinx.
Yikes. Aside from when we get down to the very mysterious door and so forth, what use do you suppose all these chambers had? What function, what use?
Well, it's going to take us some time to talk this through. This is a deep and mysterious matter, but there's something that I want to draw attention to right now, and that is the precision of the Great Pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that this monument is supposed to be the tomb of a megalomaniac pharaoh.
Right.
Although no burial was ever found inside it. The Great Pyramid weighs 6 million tons. It has a footprint of just under 14 acres, and it stands more than 450 feet tall. Mysteriously, it is perfectly aligned to true north, south, east, and west. The north-south faces of the Great Pyramid are better aligned to true north and south than the meridian building of the Greenwich Observatory in London. The Greenwich Observatory in London is 9/60 of a degree off true north. The Great Pyramid, the last surviving wonder of the ancient world, the oldest massive construction on Earth, is just 3/60 of a single degree off true north. And this tells us beyond any shadow of a doubt that astronomers of astonishing skill and talent were at work in the surveying and setting out of this amazing monument. And this is the first clue as to its function, because it speaks the language of astronomy. And astronomy is a language that can pass and transcend the passage of thousands of years and the change of cultures and symbols. It's a language that any intelligent civilization can decode. If we wish to understand these monuments, we have to look to astronomy. We have to look to the stars. And therein lies the beginning of a trail of clues that leads finally to a conclusion.
Graham, at the time the pyramids were built, did mankind have the knowledge to determine very nearly precisely true north?
Well, not according to orthodox history, no. Didn't have the knowledge to do that at all. And also, the question that arises is, when were the pyramids built? Orthodox Egyptologists say that the pyramids were built in 2500 B.C., but that, again, is a statement of opinion. These monuments are made of stone, and you cannot date stone monuments by any objective technique. Carbon dating only dates organic material.
Right.
Therefore, you need to look to other sciences to put a dating on these monuments. And we think that the story of these monuments, the chronology of these monuments, is extremely different to the chronology presented by Egyptologists. And that although the period of 2500 BC does figure in their story, it's only part of their story, and that the origins and the genesis of this amazing site go back to 10,500 BC, 12,500 years ago, the end of the last ice age, when very strange things were happening on this planet, a time of mystery and darkness about which very little is known. And the evidence that links the three great pyramids and the great sphinx to the date of 10,500 BC is astonishingly strong. And we present that evidence in the new book, in The Message of the Sphinx.
I'd like to talk a little bit about that evidence, because if you cannot date to 2,500 BC, how can you date to almost 10,000 years, even earlier than that?
Two precise sciences. One is astronomy, and the other is geology. And as I said a moment ago, it's astronomy that really holds the key to these monuments. Because what we've discovered and what we present is simply this, that the three great pyramids map on the ground the pattern of three prominent stars in the sky.
All right, hold that thought, Graham. We'll come right back to it. Graham Hancock is my guest. He's in Chicago. It doesn't matter where you are. You're in for the ride of your life. The modern-day Indiana Jones. Graham Hancock, right back. Chicago, Graham Hancock. Graham, where were we?
We were in the three stars of Orion's belt.
Yes, we were.
We were talking about the majestic plan that is transcribed on the ground of the Giza Plateau in Egypt, the plan that Egyptologists, the self-appointed academic interpreters of this site, have never noticed.
Yes.
And still to this day regard as a coincidence, if they even accept that it exists at all. To explain this plan, let me first of all preface it with a remark about a huge piece of architecture in the United States. I don't know whether I correctly refer to it as the Boulder Dam or the Hoover Dam.
Well, Boulder Dam, I think.
Boulder Dam will do. And the state, it's Colorado, or?
Well, Boulder Dam is down here. It's Nevada, Arizona.
Nevada, Arizona. Okay. The Boulder Dam includes an enormous star map. The architect who created that massive piece of architecture built into it a huge star map. He froze the stars above the dam and brought them down into a piece of architecture that he built into the dam.
Hmm.
And the reason that this was done is very interesting, because he knew what the ancient Egyptians knew, that the positions of all the stars in the sky change very, very, very slowly down the ages, as a result of a phenomenon called precession. Our planet, which is the viewing platform from which we observe all the stars in the sky, has a very slow wobble on its axis.
Mm-hmm.
And this wobble operates in a great cycle of 26,000 years. And as a result of this, the patterns and positions of all the stars in the skies change. And the reason that that piece of architecture in the Boulder Dam was put there was so that any future civilization, if ours were to be destroyed, would be able to work out when the Boulder Dam was built. Because if they had a knowledge of astronomy, they could look at that star map built into the architecture, and they could work out from that when the star map and therefore the dam was made. And it's the same principle that we find at work in the monuments of Giza. Only in the case of the monuments at Giza, it's not just a matter of dating the monument. It also helps us to get to grips with what they really mean. Two constellations are represented on the ground at Giza.
All right, Graham, before we get there, let me understand a little bit better the science of the wobble effect.
Yes.
In other words, how we are able to measure, without 26,000 years of experience in one wobble cycle,
mm-hmm.
What standard of measurement do we then use and apply toward being able to date these structures?
With very fine and precise observations, you can note that the wobble is underway over a relatively short number of years. Within a human lifetime of 72 years, this wobble on the axis of the Earth affects a 1 degree shift in the positions of the stars. Ancient cultures particularly observed it at the spring equinox. Now, the spring equinox is the time of the year when night and day are of exactly equal length, and
right.
It falls in our epoch on the 21st of March.
Mm-hmm.
And on the spring equinox, the sun rises perfectly due east of wherever you are situated on the planet. This is because our planet revolves around the sun, and there are four key moments in the year. The two other, the winter solstice and the summer solstice, are the longest and shortest days of the year. On the summer solstice, the north pole of the Earth, the summer solstice in the northern hemisphere, the north pole of the Earth points most directly at the sun because the Earth lies tilted on its axis.
Mm-hmm.
And on the winter solstice, the shortest day of the year, the 21st of December, the north pole of the Earth points most directly away from the sun. But at the equinoxes, spring and autumn equinoxes, the Earth lies broadside on to the sun in its orbit.
Then one could almost make a structure with a tiny pinpoint hole in it, and on the precise time of the precise day, measure the point where the sun hits?
Yes. And many ancient structures target the rising point of the sun on the spring equinox.
Mm-hmm.
They point perfectly due east, and one of those structures is the Great Sphinx of Egypt. The Great Sphinx of Egypt is targeted perfectly due east. Its gaze sights the rising sun on the spring equinox. In the New World, if you go to Chichen Itza in the Yucatan, you will find an enormous pyramid, the Pyramid of Kukulcan, which was one of the names of Quetzalcoatl. I went into this at some length in my previous book, Fingerprints of the Gods. And this wonderful step pyramid at Chichen Itza is also an equinoctial marker, because it is so set that on the day of the spring equinox, a wonderful effect of light and shadow is created, and a gigantic feathered serpent, which was the symbol of the civilizing deity Quetzalcoatl, is seen to undulate up and down the staircase of the pyramid. And therefore, even if you've lost touch with your calendar system, if there's been some great cataclysm and you've forgotten how to calculate your calendar, that monument will tell you when the spring equinox has occurred, and so also will the Sphinx. When the sun rises in direct alignment with the gaze of the Sphinx, it's the spring equinox. Now, for the ancients, they weren't just interested in the position that the sun rises along the horizon and it slowly changes north of east at the summer solstice, south of east at the winter solstice, perfectly due east at the spring equinox. They were also interested in the constellation, the group of stars that lay behind the sun at dawn on the spring equinox.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful, marvelous, magical coincidence of our cosmic environment that 12 great constellations lie in the plane of the Earth's orbit around the sun. And these are the 12 constellations of the zodiac. Everybody knows about the zodiac.
Indeed.
We all look at our horoscope every day.
So there are many points of measurement, not just one.
No. This is a very complex machine that we're looking at here. Think of it as a great clock, a great celestial clock operating in the heavens that we can tune into to find out where we're located in time. The point is this, because these 12 zodiacal constellations lie in the plane of the Earth's orbit around the sun, mm-hmm. it means that the sun will rise against the background of one of these constellations on the spring equinox.
Right.
The sun lies between the Earth and that constellation, and as the Earth rotates towards the sun, we see the sun rising against the background of that distant constellation. And for the ancients, the constellation that lay behind the sun on the spring equinox was considered to mark the age. That's why everybody's familiar with the notion of a new age and the notion of the dawning of the age of Aquarius. What this actually refers to is the phenomenon of precession of the equinoxes.
All right, again, the only thing that I don't understand, now I understand the number of data points you have and follow on this, but how do you make a determination from one lifetime or even several that the period of wobble is 26,000 years?
Two ways. You must have very long-term observations which plot this change in the stellar positions against the rising point of the sun over hundreds and preferably over thousands of years. And those observations must be meticulously recorded and kept.
Have we done that?
And yes, we do it now, and we've been doing it certainly since the time of the Greeks. But the evidence that we present in our books, in Fingerprints of the Gods and The Message of the Sphinx, compellingly suggests that the ancient Egyptians were doing it and that they inherited this knowledge from an earlier lost civilization, that the whole knowledge of the precession is one of the most ancient sciences of mankind. And we find the values, the numbers that relate to this astronomical phenomenon recorded in the oldest myths of mankind. There were two great scholars, Giorgio de Santillana and Hertha von Deschend, who wrote a wonderful book in the 1960s called Hamlet's Mill. And Giorgio de Santillana was no lightweight. He was professor of the history of science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. But because the idea he put forward was so much at variance with orthodox scientific view, his work was never adopted by the scientific community. But what he argued, quite simply, was that precise, accurate measurements of the rate of the precession of the equinoxes
mm-hmm.
were encoded in the most ancient myths of mankind. And curiously, these are all cataclysm myths. They're all myths that relate to the recurrent destructions of civilizations and of the Earth and of a recurrent flood and a huge global earthquake that strikes the planet. And incorporated in these myths are precise values for the rate of precession as good as our best astronomers can calculate today, a series of numbers that only make sense as references to the precession of the equinoxes and that are linked in these myths with astronomical symbolism of great intensity and cleverness. So there's powerful evidence in ancient myths that some ancient people, as yet unidentified by history, mm-hmm. were observing this phenomenon as accurately and precisely as our scientists do today. And this evidence is also encoded in monuments all around the world, including the monuments of Egypt. And they speak to us in the language of precession. They speak to us in the language of precession, and they use it to draw our attention to a particular time, to the positions and the exact patterns of the stars of two constellations, the constellation of Leo, and the constellation of Orion at a particular time, very distant in the past, and that time is 10,500 B.C.
All right. Well, that's a lot of good scientific basis for saying what you say. What do the traditionalists do with that? Do they just dismiss it? Do they say, interesting? How do they respond?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that Egyptologists are astronomically illiterate. Egyptology is a discipline that focuses on the dust of their feet, and they seek to evaluate Egyptian civilization by what they can dig out of the earth, by artifacts pulled out of the ground. And if it hasn't come out of the ground, then it doesn't fit in with their method of doing research, and therefore they ignore it. Do not look at the stars, and they do not look at the skies. And this is very strange, because the ancient Egyptians themselves were avid star watchers, and their entire religion was focused around astronomy. Even the most orthodox of Egyptologists will accept that the high god of resurrection and rebirth in the ancient Egyptian system, the god Osiris, who was said to have brought civilization to Egypt in a remote epoch that they called the first time, Zeptepi in their language, that this god Osiris was seen to have a celestial image, a celestial twin, that the constellation of Orion was considered to be the image of Osiris in the sky. This is well known and well accepted, and yet Egyptologists have never considered the implications of it. And those implications are there, staring us in the face in 15 million tons of pyramids standing on the Giza Plateau in exactly the pattern of the three stars of Orion's belt as they looked, and only as they looked, in 10,500 B.C.
All right, Graham, then the charge you're making is that our modern science is insufficiently, by comparison, integrated.
It is a science that is overly specialized.
Yes.
Egyptology makes the arrogant claim to be the sole body of knowledge capable of interpreting ancient Egyptian civilization to the modern world. And yet it is a body of knowledge, it's a system of knowledge that relies only on one method of investigation. Egyptologists do not use astronomy, and neither do they use geology. And geology is an important science when it comes to dating a very ancient site.
But I would have imagined that you would have tried to grab one of them and integrate and show him what you know and get his reaction.
No, we have tried to do that, and we've now got to the point where, in fact, we got to the point quite some time ago where we feel that it is pointless to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can present this information again and again and again to Egyptologists, and they'll say, we're sorry, this does not coincide with what we know, therefore it must be wrong. Egyptology must be one of the few sciences in which, when new facts appear which challenge the prevailing theory, instead of the theory being changed, the facts are rejected. This is the way that Egyptologists do business, and this is what has happened in this case. But we're dealing here with an extraordinarily clever ancient people who went to great lengths to pass knowledge about themselves down to the future. And they used the language of the stars and the language of this phenomenon of precession so carefully and so cleverly that there can be no mistake about it. And I've presented this information, Robert Bovale has presented this information, jointly we've presented this information to thousands of people, ordinary people, people like you and I, and they look at the information and their common sense tells them this has to be right. And that's why the name Egyptologist these days raises a giggle rather than a serious response, because the Egyptologists are still insisting that all of this is coincidence. And we'll lay out during the course of this evening the evidence that supports why this is not a coincidence and why it provides the key to a deep and mysterious secret of the past of humanity.
Suppose I were a modern contractor and some very rich entity in Egypt came to me and said, I want to build this pyramid. And he gave me the design for one of the great pyramids.
Mm.
As a contractor, could I do it?
I don't think so. My co-author, Robert Bovale, is a construction engineer. This was one of the reasons we teamed up, because we're able to bring different skills to bear on this problem. Robert is a construction engineer by training. He spent 20 years building enormous buildings in the Middle East. And his background was specifically as a sucking out engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And Robert, therefore, has looked in depth into the construction aspects of the Great Pyramid from a professional point of view. You know, Egyptologists have the view that the pyramid was built by teams of men hauling blocks of stone up ramps.
Yes.
But and that's the view that is presented in all the popular texts as though it were a fact. Again, there is no evidence for that view whatsoever. It's a simple fact of construction that human labor cannot haul blocks of stone weighing tens of tons each, and some of the blocks in the pyramid weigh more than 70 tons, and there are blocks in neighboring temples that weigh more than 200 tons. But human labor simply cannot haul blocks of stone up a ramp that has an incline steeper than 1 in 10. And to take a 1 in 10 ramp to the top of a 450-foot tall structure requires a ramp almost 1 mile in length, involving about 5 times as much material as is used in the Great Pyramid itself.
Wow.
And that material is to be found nowhere around the flat desert plateau on which the pyramids stand. And furthermore, the ramp itself would have had to have been made of blocks of stone as solid as those are used in the pyramid, otherwise it would have collapsed under its own weight. There is a great mystery regarding the construction of these monuments. In fact, Robert and I have put out a suggestion through various construction engineering journals in Britain to get a team of people together to try to really puzzle out how these monuments were built. We feel we have to dispense entirely with this Egyptological nonsense about slaves and gangs of men drawing blocks of stone up ramps a mile long. And we feel we have to look into this problem very seriously. I've climbed the Great Pyramid 3 times. It's illegal to climb it, but certain arrangements can be made. And I've climbed it 3 times. And on one of those occasions, which happened just after a great festival that was taking place in Egypt in 1995, the so-called the Eid that follows the holy month of Ramadan, there were 30,000 citizens of Cairo on the Giza Plateau having a picnic. They were having a holiday. And 200 or 300 of them decided to climb the Great Pyramid, even though the guards didn't want to do that. And myself and my wife, Samantha, joined those climbers, and we climbed the Great Pyramid in broad daylight, illegally, with a lot of Egyptians also climbing it. And we discovered something very interesting.
Don't they frown on that?
Well, they do frown on it, and they said it was forbidden, but since hundreds of other people were doing it, it seemed a reasonable proposition for us to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing was this, that the climb itself is physically dangerous. I've climbed it on 2 other occasions when we climbed it alone, without other people climbing it, and that was dangerous enough. But to climb it when hundreds of other people are climbing it is astonishingly dangerous. And the biggest danger of all is the other people who are passing you going up and down on the monument.
Domino effect.
A domino effect. You can literally get knocked off. And if you fall off this monument, then you're going to go all the way down to the bottom and you're going to die. And it's going to be very, very messy. Strawberry jam. And the situation that I started to wonder about was this. The Egyptological scenario sees thousands of men swarming all over this monument.
I've seen the movies.
Yeah. Transporting blocks of stone weighing 2.5 tons each minimum. That's the lowest weight of a block of stone on the pyramid. Now, 2.5 tons is approximately, what, 4 family-sized automobiles in weight.
Big, yeah.
And the Egyptological view is that hundreds or thousands of men are gaily swarming all over the pyramid, hauling these blocks up and down.
Well, when you
I can tell you it's not possible. You can't even walk up and down it safely with just a couple of hundred people.
Graham, you didn't tell me that. When you tell them that
when I tell them that, they ignore it. This is why this is why we feel that the Egyptological establishment has to be bypassed, that it is no longer relevant to this debate. It has shown that it is not intellectually competent to deal with the staggering challenges that these monuments represent. And as we show in the message of the Sphinx, Egyptology is also a deeply corrupt and dishonest discipline, which has been involved in most peculiar scams and scandals at the pyramids over the last 20 years, and which has not been honest with the public about certain matters that are taking place there, which has kept silent while the Sphinx and the 3 great pyramids have been hijacked by 2 powerful multimillionaires.
I take it you don't speak often at Egyptology conventions.
No, we do not speak at Egyptology conventions. But talking about conventions, we are inviting Egyptologists to attend a conference that's going to be held at the University of Delaware.
All right, Graham, hold on. We'll tell them all about it in a moment. We
okay.
Break here. We'll be right back. All right, here's a question for you. Regarding the stones, which I think you've adequately shown could not be hauled up today
mm-hmm.
intact, what about the theory that the stones instead were poured in place.
Yes, this is the theory of a man called Davidovits, and he put it forward in quite an interesting book published about 12 years ago. The stones were not poured intact. They contain ancient fossils of Numulites. So these are ancient sea creatures that dwelled in ancient oceans out of which the limestone sediments were formed. And I'm afraid that the fact that these stones are made of Numulitic limestone rules out the possibility that that this was some kind of concrete.
Those fossils would have been liquefied.
Yes. I mean, they wouldn't be found in a concrete. It's a cool theory. It's interesting. It's neat, but it just is not supported by the evidence. But it shows the questions that these incredible structures raise, that somebody would go to that length to develop a theory like that to try to explain this, because that would be a way of explaining how they got these big blocks up to such a height, is if they were pouring them into molds at that height from a liquid solution. But I'm afraid it just doesn't work, and the theory does not hold water. To coin a phrase.
Yes.
It's a slightly crazy theory, but it's not nearly as crazy as the orthodox theory which Egyptologists put forward about gangs of slaves hauling these things up ramps.
And all right. Well, all right, so it couldn't have been poured, it couldn't have been hauled. How did they get there?
Well, I think that the most honest answer to that question is this. We just don't know. Be open-minded about this. Let's not approach this monument with fixed ideas. Let's approach it with open minds and questions.
So
in
with
our
all
minds,
the, with...
and let's try and resolve these questions. In order to do that, we first of all have to sweep away the dead hand of Egyptology and open the subject to rational debate from large numbers of people all around the world. People who bring different skills to bear on these monuments. Engineers, architects, philosophers, astronomers, geologists, people from all walks of life who seriously have the capacity to study these monuments need to be brought there and need to consider these monuments. Can I mention that conference in the University of Delaware?
Absolutely.
Because this could be a forum where this could be aired. We're issuing a challenge to Egyptologists to join us at that conference and to debate with us. It's at the University of Delaware. It's called Return to the Source, Rediscovering Lost Knowledge and Ancient Wisdom. I'll be speaking at that conference. So will John Anthony West, the most courageous and far-sighted American who's been working on the problem of the age of the Sphinx for the last 20 years. So will Professor Robert Schock of Boston University, whose geological studies have shown that the Sphinx is thousands of years older than Egyptologists think it is. So will Robert Boval. So will Rand and Rose Flemath, whose work on Earth crust displacement I reported in Fingerprints of the Gods, and whose own book, When the Sky Fell, I would highly recommend to anybody who's interested in ancient catastrophes, and they'll be talking about Earth crust displacement and the mystery of the end of the last ice age. So will Colin Wilson from England and many other independent thinkers who are working on the past of mankind. And this conference is taking place at the University of Delaware 27, 28, and 29 September. And I can give out two numbers that people can call if they're interested in attending that conference.
Well, give them a little incentive. If I were an Egyptologist out there this morning, I'm not sure that I would walk into the arena you just described for fear of being ganged up on.
Well, we would like a gang of Egyptologists.
Well, all right, but
dozens of
Graham,
them to come.
Graham, even if just one shows up, will he get a good fair debate?
Oh, yes, very much so. We feel that fair debate is very important because we don't claim what they claim. We don't claim to be the sole source of knowledge on this subject. Our main role is to raise questions and to show that so far the questions have not been answered, but we think that the best way forward is through constructive debate and dialogue. And we'll all be presenting papers at that conference, but we would like Egyptologists to come and present papers, and we will set up a forum for debate where these issues can be openly aired in front of the public. And no, they certainly won't be ganged up on, and that's more than we can say for what they've done to us over the years.
All right, give the phone numbers.
Okay. One number is 302-831-2216, and the contact there is Carol Ziefried. That's 302-831-2216. Contact Carol Ziefried, or else speak to Barbara Keller on 609-965-2216. 3657. I'll repeat. Barbara Keller on 609-965-3657. And this is for the conference at the University of Delaware between 27 and 29 September this year.
Well, that should be a fiery event if some show up.
Yes. Well, we'll all be there. As I say, myself, Robert Bovall, John Anthony West, Professor Robert Schock, and others presenting papers on this forgotten episode in human history and what it might mean for all of us.
All right.
And we hope that Egyptologists will debate with us there and other scholars of history.
There was a very interesting program that ran here in America. I don't know if it ran in Britain. Have you seen it? I'm sure you have. The Mysterious Origins of Man.
I appeared on it.
That's right. You did.
I was most of the last half of that program. I was the guy that they filmed walking around in Stonehenge.
That's right.
And then they did a long interview with me. That was about the theme of my book, Fingerprints of the Gods.
Yes, yes. Well,
which explored the possibility of a lost civilization all around the world. Yes, it was an excellent program, and interestingly enough, Bill Cote, who made that program, was deluged with hate mail established academics. In fact, there was a campaign to try to get that program pulled off the air. I mean, America, I was always told, was supposed to be the home of freedom of speech.
Mm.
But when I read this ream of hate mail, which piles up about 3 feet tall, I suddenly realized that there's a whole movement in this country that does not want people to speak out.
Was it aired in Britain?
It has not been aired in Britain yet. I hope that it will be. The earlier film, also documentary, also presented by Charlton Heston, The Mystery of the Sphinx, in which John West and Robert Schock's work on the vast antiquity of the Sphinx was first put before the public, was shown in Britain. They did a recut and re-edited version, and they added some new material to it, which, by the way, entirely supported the findings on the geology of the Sphinx.
Well, among the many findings in Mysterious Origins, there was the theory that the continents on the world have shifted, and what is the Arctic or Antarctic then becomes something else.
That's right. This is the theory of Earth crust displacement, and as I say, I would mention Randon Rose Flemath's book, When the Sky Fell, which is excellent work on that theory, and I also cover it at length in Fingerprints of the Gods. The theory was first developed by an American academic, an American historian of science called Professor Charles Hapgood, back in the early 1950s. And Charles Hapgood was supported at the time, and this is very important, as to the physics of his theory of Earth crust displacement by no less a figure than Albert Einstein. And Albert Einstein was a man who knew his physics.
All right, give us the short version.
Okay, well, the short version is this. We've all heard of continental drift. We've all heard of plate tectonics. We all now know that the continents of the Earth move around on the surface of the Earth very, very slowly, like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. Look at West Africa and the east coast of South America. You can see that they once fitted together and that they've drifted apart.
Mm-hmm.
And this, by the way, this theory of continental drift was not accepted when it was first proposed in 1916. It was universally ridiculed, and it took more than 50 years for geologists to come to terms with the fact that it is a reality. But now that's the basis of all modern geology. The theory of Earth crust displacement is not contradictory with continental drift. It doesn't it does not contradict it. It actually works together with it. It suggests that from time to time there's another motion of the Earth's crust. In addition to the continents rearranging themselves in relation to one another, sometimes the entire outer crust of the Earth can shift in one piece around the body of the Earth.
Yikes.
Like the loose skin of an orange.
Kind of a continental little game you play with chairs where you run around. Everything shifts all at once.
Everything shifts at once. The whole thing moves at once. And when this happens, land that is in very cold parts of the planet, close to one or other of the poles, is cataclysmically shifted into warm parts of the planet. And land that is in warm parts of the planet is cataclysmically shifted into cold parts of the planet.
And what's the best evidence for this?
Well, the best evidence for this is the mystery of the last ice age. Again, we don't have time to go into vast detail here. All of it is in Fingerprints of the Gods. But the mystery of the last ice age is this. We all know there was an ice age. We all know that North America was covered with ice more than 2 miles thick. 6 million square miles of it, as far south as the Mississippi Delta, almost into the tropics. And this ice was stable for 100,000 years. And then suddenly, around 14,000 years ago, for reasons that no geologist has ever been able to explain, it all melted. Just within 1,000 or 2,000 years, the whole lot melted. The same thing happened in Northern Europe. The same quantity of ice was stable for the same length of time, and it all melted down within just a couple of thousand years. Sea levels went up by 400 feet. Hundreds of animal species, the woolly mammoth, the woolly rhinoceros, the saber-toothed tiger, hundreds of animal species were rendered extinct during this gigantic cataclysm that brought the last ice age to an end, and it was, by definition, a cataclysm. This was no slow-acting climate change. The question is, what caused the cataclysm? Mm-hmm. Earth crust displacement provides a very simple and elegant, clear answer, as Hapgood and Einstein showed back in 1953. It argues simply that we have masses of ice on our planet now. We have an ice age now at the North Pole and at the South Pole.
Indeed.
In the cold latitudes. And this ice is asymmetrically distributed around the poles. It isn't evenly distributed around the spin axis of the Earth. Look at Greenland, which is way off center to the rest of the ice. If you look at Antarctica, you'll find that the ice on the Antarctic plain, on the polar plain, is twice as thick as the ice on the Antarctic Peninsula. It's uneven, it's unstable. And with our spinning planet, and it's spinning at 1,000 miles an hour at the equator, and it's going around the sun at almost 70,000 miles an hour, with all these centrifugal and rotational forces, this huge, unstable mass of ice, not symmetrically distributed around the poles, creates an extremely deadly and dangerous situation. And at widely separated intervals, as it builds up to a particular level, as Einstein argued, it can exert sufficient thrust on the crust of the Earth. And we all live on the Earth's crust. It's just 30 miles thick, and it floats on a lubricating layer. It can exert sufficient thrust on the crust of the Earth to set the whole crust in motion, moving in one piece, moving very, very fast, creating enormous tidal waves, huge earthquakes across the whole planet, filling the air with volcanic dust, a darkness, a time of darkness, and all the myths of mankind speak of such an event, speak of black, bituminous rain falling from the skies and huge floods, the flood of Noah. And it may just be that that's what these myths remember, the cataclysm that brought the last ice age to an end. And it may just be that all our memories of a great golden age in the story of mankind, of a high civilization that was destroyed in an enormous cataclysm long ago, it may just be that that is connected to this mystery.
All right, Graham, answer this. If that were to occur today,
yes,
with all our great cities and all our industry and all our population and all of the artifacts that are us today, if that cataclysm occurred today, what would be left of, or seen or found, of our great civilization after the shift?
Almost nothing. Almost nothing. The face of the Earth would be wiped clean. I have to stress, it might not be Earth crust displacement, but there is some cataclysmic agent that strikes the Earth at regular and widely separated intervals of time. It may be a massive asteroid strike, a 10-mile-wide nickel-iron asteroid incoming at cosmic speed would have the same effect. It could knock the Earth off its axis. It could create a kind of nuclear winter. Our civilization would be destroyed by that, too. One of the things that my research has done to me when I was working on Fingerprints of the Gods was make me realize how fragile this beautiful blue planet of ours is, this garden of experience on which we all live, how fragile our cosmic environment makes our life on this Earth, and how easily we could lose it. The answer to your question is modern civilization, with all its much vaunted achievements, could be rubbed out in the blink of an eye. And there might just be a handful of survivors. And those survivors, I am sure, would do their best to keep the light of our knowledge burning and to pass it down to the future, just as the survivors of that great lost civilization of the past sought to do so. And I think that that's what we're seeing in the pyramids and the Sphinx of Giza, a memory device containing a time capsule of knowledge from a lost civilization of long, long ago, knowledge and wisdom that may be of vital importance to us today.
Behind that door in the Sphinx, does the library of that knowledge lie?
I think there is extraordinarily powerful evidence to suggest that this is so. If you were amongst the survivors of a high civilization, and you had been, your civilization had been destroyed in an enormous cataclysm,
yes,
and you wanted somehow to keep the memory of your civilization preserved and to pass down the knowledge to the future. And you might particularly want to do that if you believed passionately in the reincarnation of the soul, by the way, because you might believe that you would come back. And the ancient Egyptians inherited a system of religious ideas that did believe in the reincarnation of the soul. You might want to pass that knowledge down to the future to wake yourself up at some distant time. If you had such knowledge, you wouldn't just put it in one place. You would, as it were, make a backup copy of your precious disc. And that's why we think that there is more than one place of refuge for this time capsule. That's why there is a deeply buried chamber in the bedrock beneath the Great Sphinx. And that's why there is a hidden chamber, the doorway of which has now been discovered inside the Great Pyramid of Egypt.
All right, this theory presupposes that that civilization understood what was going to occur.
It presupposes that they had very little time and very little warning, that there were a few survivors, and that they did do their best with the high knowledge they had preserved to create a sanctuary for that knowledge and to pass it down to the future. And they used many different techniques to do this. But one of the ways they did it was in creating these gigantic monuments and in concealing within them something of extraordinary importance. And clues as to what that might be are contained in the vast literature of the ancient Egyptians, because the ancient Egyptians were the inheritors of this civilization. They spoke of these survivors as the gods. They spoke of the time when the gods came to Egypt,
yes,
far off in a remote epoch called the first time. The god of Cyrus, the god of resurrection and rebirth, the god Thoth, the god of high magic and wisdom, the goddess Isis, Horus.